Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
It's good to be back in the United States after almost 1 month in California. Okay, it's been a long time since our last class. We will continue where we left off. We were studying the section on the chapter on wisdom, and we were already into the discourse on right view. This is the Samaditti Sutta. And from this sutta, we've examined the sections on wholesome and unwholesome karma, and the section on the four nutriments. Correct?
Page number?
Excuse me?
Page number?
The page number is 325. We're about to start the section on the four nutriments. Okay, so this is the Venerable Sariputta. He's speaking to the monks. And each time he's explaining the meaning of samaditti, right view, how one is a person with right view. And each time he finishes his explanation, the monks ask him to give another explanation of right view. So now we're on the bottom of page 325, this is paragraph 13. And so here the monks ask the Sariputta, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who is confirmed or unwavering confidence in the Dhamma, and has arrived at this true Dhamma, this good Dhamma? Okay, so then Venerable Sariputta says there is, and then paragraph 14, he enumerates, or he uses the Four Noble Truths as the subject for explaining the right view. So, looking at the text says, when, friends, a noble disciple understands suffering, the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the way leading to the cessation of suffering. In that way, he is one of right view and so on, and has arrived at this true Dhamma. Okay, so here, Sariputta takes as the subject the Four Noble Truths. Now, what's interesting to observe is that usually, we just take the Four Noble Truths as being the cardinal teaching of Buddhism, the principal teaching of Buddhism. But from this sutta, what we can see is that the main principle of the Buddha's teaching is the principle of conditionality. And so we have many different applications of this principle of conditionality. And they differ from one another simply insofar as they fill in different content into the principle of conditionality. Did I relate the story earlier about how Venerable Sariputta first met the Buddha's teaching through his contact with the monk Asaji? Did I do that in this class?
I think so.
No. No. I think this little story gives us some way to understand what is taking place in this particular sutta, at least the way I see it. Okay, the story is that there were two friends, young Brahmin boys who had been born about the same time. They grew up in villages close together, villages that were near one another. And the two families had been friends for generations, and so the two boys would often meet, play together. Perhaps they had their Brahminic education together under the same guru. Okay, one boy, his first name was Upatissa, and his mother was named Sari. And so he came to be called Sariputta, which means the son of the mother whose name is Sari. And then the other boy was named, proper name was Kolita, but he belonged to a long-standing Brahmin family named, the family name was Moggallana. Okay, so the two boys, they grew up together, they passed through their boyhood together, they passed through adolescence together. Then when they became young men, they would often go out on outings together. Then one day, perhaps they were in their 20s at this time, a kind of traveling troupe of actors came to, they were growing up near the city of Rajagaha, which was the capital city of the state of Magadha. Then one day, this troupe of traveling actors came to the city of Rajagaha and staged a performance which extended over several days. There would be drama, comedy, singing, dancing, and so on. Okay, so on the first day, they call this the Hilltop Festival, which was conducted on a hill outside the city of Rajagaha. Okay, so on the first day, these two young men bought tickets to the festival, they went to the festival, and they enjoyed themselves immensely. When there was drama taking place, they were excited and intensely interested. When there was a comedy, they would laugh. When the singing was taking, when songs were being played, they would sing along. Perhaps when dancing was going on, they would watch the dances. Okay, so they enjoyed themselves the first day. The next day, they decided to buy tickets and attend again. So this time they attended and they watched. And as they were watching, their interest was starting to fade a little bit. Somehow, the drama, the comedy, the songs, the dancing did not awaken their interest as keenly as it did on the first day. But still, they decided, let's go on, watch it the third day. And so again, the third day came around, they bought tickets, they went to the festival. And as they were sitting there watching the performances, both of them at the same time had the same thought. Both of them were thinking, these actors who look so beautiful, so handsome, who are so full of life and energy, after 100 years, they'll all be dead. And we too will also be dead. So all life is impermanent. What is the use of just enjoying ourselves, past spending our time in worldly, sensual enjoyments? I think I should leave the home life and go out and become a wanderer seeking a path to liberation. So both of them had the same thoughts at the same time, yet didn't tell the other. But when they had left the festival as they were walking to their homes, each of them noticed that the other seemed rather somber. And so first, Kolita asked his friend Upatissa, Sariputta, why is it that today you don't seem so cheerful? And then Sariputta told him the thought that was on his mind. And then he said to his friend Kolita, and you too, you don't seem so full of joy, full of humor today. What's been weighing on your mind? And then Kolita said, I've had exactly the same thought that you've had. And so together, they decided to leave their home life and go out and seek a path to liberation. And so they, perhaps secretly, without informing their parents, renounced the home life. They gave up their worldly clothes, and they put on yellow robes, shaved their heads, and they went searching all over northern India, seeking some teacher who could guide them and enlighten them. But in the end, they didn't find anybody who really satisfied them. At the time, they were staying under a teacher whose name was Sanjaya. They weren't really satisfied with his teaching, but they just decided that he seemed to be quite clever, intellectually gifted teacher, and so they would live at his ashram and receive instructions from him. But one day, the two went off. Each day they would go off to different villages to collect their alms food. So one day, Sariputta had gone to a village. He had finished his own alms round when suddenly he saw coming down a path one of the Buddha's first five disciples, whose name was Asaji. This was a monk who was walking very serenely, very calmly, mindful, fully aware, fully alert. Each time he would stop at a house, he would collect a little alms food, he would bless the donor, and then go on quietly to the next house. And so when Sariputta saw this monk walking an alms round, immediately his eyes just fixed on him, and his mind devoured the sight. He thought, this is truly an enlightened person, one who has reached the goal that we have been seeking ourselves. And so he waited till this monk Asaji had finished his alms round. Then he approached the monk Asaji and asked him, who are you? Do you train under some teacher? Who is your teacher? Under whom have you left the household life? Then Asaji told him that there is a prince from the Shakya clan who has become the enlightened one. They call him the Buddha, or the Bhagavan, the Blessed One. And that is, he said, this is my teacher, and I follow his training. Then Sariputta said, what is his teaching? Please explain his teaching to me. So Asaji said, this is not yet the time for explanation. I've just finished my alms round. Please wait until I finish my meal. Okay, so Sariputta went off to the side. Asaji finished taking his meal. And then Sariputta approached him again and asked for teaching. Then Asaji said, I really don't, even though he was an arhat, fully liberated, but he was also very modest and humble. He said, I really don't know the teacher's teaching in detail, and so I can't explain it to you at great length. But Sariputta said, I don't need a detailed explanation. Just tell me the essence. Tell me the core of his teaching. Then Asaji replied, in that case, I'll just tell you the basic principle of the whole teaching. Then Asaji said, Ye dhamma hetu bhava te sanja hetu tathagato aha yo cha te san nirodho evam vadi mahasamano. Whatever things there are that originate from a cause, the Tathagata, that is the Buddha, has declared the cause, and also that which is their cessation. This is the teaching of the great ascetic. And when Asaji spoke those verses, then Sariputta, right on the spot, gained the first stage of enlightenment. This is called the arising of Dhammacakku, the eye of the Dhamma. Okay, so this verse became, let's say, the trigger that ignited the enlightenment experience in Sariputta. Whatever dhammas, whatever phenomena there are that originate from a cause, the Buddha has explained their cause and also their cessation. So in this simple four-line stanza, we have the principle of causation, or the principle of conditional arising, in the two modes, the two aspects, the aspect of origination and the aspect of cessation. And so the question is, what are these dhammas that originate from a cause? And the way I understand the Samaditti Sutta, it's almost like Sariputta's commentary on this verse through which he gained enlightenment. Here he's explaining from different angles the phenomena that originate from cause, that originate from conditions. He's explaining what their conditions are and how they cease through the cessation of their conditions. And so we saw this already with regard to the wholesome and unwholesome types of action, which originate from respectively the wholesome and unwholesome roots. And now we see the same thing in regard to the, well, we've already seen the same thing with regard to the four nutriments. And now in this section, we see this with regard to dukkha or suffering. And so the Four Noble Truths, though they're given so much attention when people are explaining Buddhism, but when we examine them in relation to other teachings of the Buddha, what we can see is that the Four Noble Truths are simply elaborating this principle of conditionality, the principle of conditional arising, using suffering as the subject matter. Okay, so first in paragraph 14, Sariputta gives the concise teaching. And then in 15, in order to elaborate, first he raises the questions, what is meant by suffering? What is the origin of suffering? What is the cessation of suffering? And what is the way leading to the cessation of suffering? Okay, the word suffering in Pali is dukkha. And so the Four Noble Truths are usually explained, well, let's say they're usually stated simply by using the four key terms that represent each truth. so the four main terms in Pali are dukkha, which is what is translated as suffering, then the word samudaya, which means origination, origin or origination. The word udaya means arising, and then sam, the prefix sam, suggests some degree of complexity. So it's not just a simple arising, but a complex process of origination. Then the word nirodha means stopping or cessation. And magga is path or way. And then these four noble truths fall actually into two groups. The first two truths represent the aspect of, we call this bondage. We can say it's the aspect of samsara becoming, the aspect of repeated existence within samsara around of birth and death. And the second two truths represent liberation, how one becomes free from bondage to samsara. And then within these two groups, the two truths are connected in a cause and effect relationship. And so the truth of origin, samudaya, is the cause, the underlying cause for dukkha, for suffering. And then the path, the magga, here we have to introduce a little qualification. The path is not the cause for cessation, but the path is the means for attaining the cessation of suffering. This is because the cessation of suffering is actually, the ultimate meaning is nirvana, nibbana. And so the path isn't the cause that brings nirvana into existence, because nirvana is said to be always existing. But the path is the way to reach nibbana, to attain nibbana. I illustrate this with a little simile. It's like we might have a city, like New York City, and then we have a road like Tacoma Parkway. And so, no, it's not Tacoma, it's Taconic Parkway.
Taconic.
This is Tacoma, Washington. Yes, Taconic Parkway is the road for reaching New York City. So if we take the road, then we reach the city. But the road doesn't bring the city into existence. Okay, so this is the relationship between these four truths. Often it's said in popular books on Buddhism that the Buddha modeled the four truths after a formula that was used in Indian medicine. That is, when a physician is treating an illness, what he does first is to diagnose the illness. That's like the first noble truth. Then the physician has to find out what is the cause of the illness. That's like the second noble truth. Then the physician has to find out whether the illness can be cured. That is the third noble truth. Then the physician prescribes a course of treatment that is like the fourth noble truth, the truth of the path. So it's commonly said, often you'll read this, that the Buddha modeled the four noble truths after this formula used in Indian medicine. And the reason why I'm saying you'll read this in popular books on Buddhism is because there are no medical treatises from before the time of the Buddha. And early Indian medicine was very much influenced by Buddhism. Some of the foremost writers of the medical treatises were Buddhists. So it's quite possible, rather than the Buddha having been influenced by the medical formula, that the authors of the medical treatises in ancient India were influenced instead by the Buddha's formula of the Four Noble Truths in setting out the process for treating an illness. Okay, so now let us go back to the sutta and see how the Four Noble Truths are now going to be explained in greater detail. So now the Buddha begins with, it's not the Buddha, it's Venerable Sariputta, but he's actually just using the Buddha's words. So Sariputta is to explain the first noble truth, the truth of suffering. So what is suffering? Birth is suffering, aging is suffering, illness is suffering, death is suffering, sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and despair are suffering. Not to get what one wants is suffering. In brief, the five aggregates subject to clinging are suffering. So this is called suffering. So in this first noble truth, we have the fact or the truth of suffering explained by simply enumerating different types of suffering. And these different types of suffering, though they're run together in the text, but we could divide them up in different ways. So one way we could do this is by taking first types of physical or bodily suffering. Here we have birth, aging, illness, and death. Four types of bodily suffering. Then we have different types of mental or psychological suffering. Sorrow, lamentation, dejection, and despair. Pain in the middle is a bodily suffering. Okay, and then not to get what one wants is suffering. This is also a type of psychological suffering. But then the last statement, it's more difficult, and that is the five aggregates subject to clinging or suffering. So what are these five aggregates? The five aggregates are bodily form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness. We've met the five aggregates again and again. But here, the Buddha, Sariputta, following the Buddha, calls these five suffering. This doesn't mean that the five aggregates are always painful, always in a state of dejection or sorrow. But this is now pointing to a different dimension of the meaning of dukkha. Here the sense is not a kind of felt or experienced suffering, but the actual meaning is unsatisfactory, imperfect, inadequate. And so why are the five aggregates said to be dukkha, in the sense that they're imperfect, unsatisfactory, inadequate? The reason is that they are all impermanent. Because they are impermanent, arising and passing away, one cannot find in them any kind of permanent happiness, any kind of permanent security and satisfaction. If one clings to the five aggregates, taking them to be mind, myself, or if one is seeking happiness in the five aggregates, then the result will be disappointment. And then one will experience actual suffering. But even when we are experiencing happiness and pleasure through the five aggregates, there is some kind of subtle clinging to them. Some kind of subtle clinging to this experience of happiness and joy. And that underlying clinging is making us vulnerable to suffering in the future when our experience changes. When we fail to obtain what we want, and then the five aggregates will become actual suffering. And so all the time, as long as there is this underlying clinging in the five aggregates, the five aggregates themselves are dukkha in the sense that they are unsatisfactory, incapable of giving us the deep, lasting, permanent satisfaction that we crave for. And so I call the five aggregates. We spoke about physical suffering, then psychological suffering, and now I would call the five aggregates themselves, I use a rather philosophical term, existential suffering. Existential suffering. So constantly throughout our existence, from birth to death, all of our worldly experience, even deep experience of meditative, higher meditative states like the jhanas, is dukkha, because it's, we say, it's the breeding ground of clinging. And this clinging is what builds up our vulnerability to experienced suffering. The clinging is what makes us vulnerable to suffering. Okay, another way to divide up these different aspects of suffering can make a threefold distinction of occasional suffering, repeated or frequent suffering, and constant dukkha. Okay, the occasional suffering, this is birth, because in any life one is born only once. Aging, of course when you get old then it's constant, but none of us get there, even when we're 80 years old, we think, when I get old, then I'll be subject to suffering. And illness, well, for most people, illness is something that happens occasionally. Though there are some who have chronic illness, then unfortunately that becomes for them chronic suffering. And then death is something that only happens once in a lifetime. Okay, so those are the types of occasional suffering. The types of, well, frequent suffering. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and despair. Well, maybe despair is not so common, but the other types of suffering people go through repeatedly in the course of a lifetime. And also not to get what one wants, this is very common. Then the five aggregates subject to clinging, this is constant, continuous dukkha. Okay, there's another way in which the text explains the meaning of dukkha. And this is by enumerating three types of suffering. Maybe I'll use the Pali words for these. Dukkha-dukkhita, this is, it means dukkha due to felt or experienced suffering. So this includes all bodily and mental painful experience. When we add the ending ta-ta, dukkha-ta, it just turns it into a noun or an abstract noun. So we could say that this is suffering due to bodily and mental painful experience. Then the second type is called viparinama dukkata. This is suffering due to change. And this refers to all types of pleasant experiences, all types of happy experiences of happiness, joy, delight, satisfaction, contentment, in which there's some underlying clinging or grasping. Because when this pleasant, enjoyable experience changes, then we undergo felt, experienced suffering. So even when one is in the midst of delight and pleasure, so let's say the wealthy financier who's living in a Manhattan penthouse, and he might have homes in the countryside, another home on the French Riviera, and he has a private plane. Private plane, what else does he have? The yacht. What can we give him in addition? Beautiful wife. Two charming little children. What else to make this life really
Jewels and fine paintings. Jewels and fine paintings.
Okay. He has some jewelry? Maybe the wife has a jewelry. Mm-hmm. But he's an art connoisseur. He has the paintings on the wall. Okay, so maybe everything that life can offer, so he imagines. But then stock market crashes, his investments fail. So he has to sell the home on the Riviera, has to give up his plane, private plane, sell the yacht. Then his wife becomes disgusted with him, takes the two children, moves away to support himself. He decides to sell the paintings, to move out of the penthouse. So everything changes, and now all of that glory vanished and gone. And so now he feels so miserable, so dejected. But even let's assume that no stock market crash, but he's making $500 million a year. But then he learns that his competitor is making $700 million a year. And so he reads some report, Mr. Bernstein getting $700 million, I'm getting $500 million. Oh, this is terrible. How can I continue to live under these conditions? And so he's never satisfied. He has to go on, maybe cheating, embezzling funds, or maybe striving to impress the board of directors so that he'll get a raise or some benefits to get up to $700 million. So now he's got maybe $800 million. So now he's very happy, very satisfied. But then his competitor, he finds out he got a raise, he's getting $1 billion. So now, he's so miserable. Can't be satisfied, $800 million a year. But he feels like he's a pauper. Okay, so now he's with $800 million, he's not satisfied. So this is the way this kind of satisfaction is so subjective. Okay, so this is suffering due to change in one's fortunes, and things that would normally be causes of happiness and satisfaction become causes of experienced suffering. The third type of dukkha, this is called sankhara dukkha. This means the suffering due to, it's a little hard to translate, due to conditioned formations. And this is the unsatisfactory nature of the five aggregates themselves. Because what is it that we take to be I or myself? It's just this compound of the five aggregates, which are factors of existence that are impermanent, always changing, arising and passing away. And so when we look at them very closely, we see that they're really dukkha. But this is a type of understanding of dukkha that ordinarily we don't have this. This is something that can only be experienced by the people who gain very deep insight. In our ordinary condition, we don't find or feel the five aggregates to be unsatisfactory or dukkha. But when we gain very deep insight and we see how these five aggregates, what we call ourself, is just a set of five aggregates that are always arising and passing away, then we can experience these five aggregates as being dukkha. One commentary compares this to, you know, sometimes you get a hair in the eye, and it's very painful, right? But now, if we take the hair and we put the hair in the palm of the hand, do you feel it as painful? So this is the way, we are in our ordinary life. We have the five aggregates; they're always arising and passing away. But our minds, our undeveloped mind, is like the hand. We don't experience the five aggregates as being painful, just as the hand doesn't experience the hair as being painful. But if we get the hair gets into the eye, oh, then somebody might put the most delicious food on a table and say, please enjoy yourself, and we can't even think of eating. Somebody might play the most beautiful music, we don't want to listen. Or somebody says, let us go out, take a trip to the countryside, enjoy the scenery. Oh, we don't want to go out in the car. All we think about is getting that air out of our eyes, right? And so this is like the condition of the mind which has developed insight into the five aggregates. When one can directly experience these five aggregates as just events arising and passing, then one understands they are really dukkha. Okay, so these are different ways in which we can understand this first noble truth, the truth of dukkha or suffering. Okay, now we come to the second noble truth. What is the origin of suffering? Okay, the text gives a little standard formula. It says, it is this craving that leads to renewed existence, to repeated becoming, accompanied by delight and lust, seeking delight here and there. That is, craving for sensual pleasures, craving for existence, craving for extermination. This is called the origin of suffering. Okay, so the word that's being translated here as craving is tanha. Pali word is tanha, which comes from a root meaning thirst, to be thirsty. And since Sanskrit and English are distant relatives, we could see the word thirst more clearly in the Sanskrit form, Trishna. Okay, some people sometimes say that for Buddhism, desire is the cause of suffering. And therefore, to get rid of suffering, one has to get rid of desire. But this is a little bit misleading, because the word, the Pali word that corresponds to desire, chanda, sometimes has a good meaning. So the Buddha encourages wholesome desire, desire to do things that are good and wholesome. But what he teaches is to overcome tanha. Tanha is this self-centered craving, this blind craving, this insatiable thirst, and this craving is described as puno pavita. This is what is translated, leads to renewed existence. The word pono bhavika, it's based on another word, punabhava. Punabhava means becoming again, or literally again becoming, repeated becoming, repeated existence. And so pono bhavika is an adjective based on that noun. So craving leads to repeated existence, because craving is what brings us back again and again to this round of existence, this round of rebirth. And then craving is said to be accompanied by delight and lust. Delight and lust are actually two aspects of craving. Delight, let's take lust first, lust, raga. This is the craving to obtain what one doesn't yet possess. Craving to acquire more, to acquire new things, to experience new pleasures. And then delight, this is the way craving operates when we obtain what we want, and then we become attached to it. And we take pleasure in it. We try to extract pleasure from it. But it is the nature of craving never to be satisfied with what one gets. So that's why craving is described as api tatra tatrapi nandini. It is seeking delight here and there. So, for example, if you are a music producer, you know putting out popular music. You know that every few months or so, one has to change the popular sound. You can't just let people become satisfied with the old classics. You know, in this generation, people now, they can't listen to the Beatles anymore, to the Rolling Stones, but always have to find new styles of rock. Pop music, so people not satisfied with the old music, now we have to hear the latest bands changing styles. I mean, I'm way back. Was it hard rock, heavy metal rock? I don't know the style, but always have to change. Folk rock, indie rock, with clothing, fashions, you always have to change the fashions every 3 months, every season. So, the fall fashion of 2007, when fall of 2008 comes around, You can't let people be satisfied with the fashions of fall 2007. Is this correct? Because I don't follow fashion news. So, have to change the style. So, like 1 year, the dresses become short, so, or skirts, so all the women think, we have to get the short skirts. But then the next year, the fashion designers think, if we start promoting short skirts this year, the women will think, ah, with the same color, same cut, same design. They'll think, well, we bought these skirts last year, no need to buy again this year. And so the next year, we either have to make the long skirts become fashionable, or you change the pattern. So sometimes very plain skirts will be in fashion, other times the skirts with elaborate fancy designs. Yeah, then the automobiles, every year they change auto design? Do they still do that every year?
Less so.
Less so. Now they realize that they have to, well, for one thing, the auto manufacturers are in trouble if people just won't buy the cars so much. If you just keep on changing, that would be. But I remember when I was growing up, a young boy, avidly interested in the latest model cars every year. This would be like late August, September. Always saying, what are the new models? It would be September that the new models for the following year would come out. And they were always building bigger tail fins, fancier, more aggressive looking headlights. Okay, so people are always seeking delight here and there. And then this is what goes on not only within one life, but this is what drives the round of rebirths, is that seeking delight, always seeking new experiences, new forms of pleasure. Okay, and so now we have three types of craving. Craving for sensual pleasures, it's pleasures of the five senses, five physical senses. Craving for existence, this is called bhavatana. This is the craving to go on, or to exist in a particular way. What's meant by bhava is a particular concrete state of existence. And this refers particularly to the type of craving based upon a belief in an eternal existence. And so somebody will have the idea that in such and such a heavenly realm, the beings are eternal, everlasting, and so they will have the craving to be reborn into this realm. In India, the Buddha's time, there were many different conceptions of different heavenly realms, different Brahma realms, realms of the high divinities. And so people believing in different schools of religion, different philosophical schools, would conceive one state or another of existence as being the highest, the ultimate, eternal existence. But we could also take this craving for existence to be, perhaps we could take it more concretely as being the craving to achieve some particular status, even in this human world. For example, our upcoming young businessman has the craving to become the president or CEO of the company. Maybe some young aspiring movie actress has the aspiration, the craving to become the Academy Award winning number one actress in America. Even monks have this craving. They have give out in the Buddhist countries monastic titles. You get to be Raja he pandita, sometimes very long titles, sasana, vishvakirti, sasana, sopana, rajakiya, pandita, maha, nayaka, taro. So I hear that maybe my particular branch of the monastic order is giving out this title once a year. So I have the yearning and longing, I have to be the one who gets that title. It's going to some other monk. I'm unhappy, miserable. I have to get it the next year. Then I get it and I think, now I am Vishvakirti, Sasana Sova, Rajakriya, Pandita Mahadayakata. Maybe I have a plaque in my room. Okay, craving for existence. And then comes something that seems to strike us as a bit strange. It's literally, in Pali it's called vibhavatana. Craving for existence is bhavatana, craving to become. Vibhavatana, vibhava is an end to existence, an end to becoming. And sometimes, usually it's Western interpreters explain vibhavatana as the type of craving that leads people to commit suicide. But I've never seen the term explained in this way in Buddhist texts. In fact, very seldom is any explanation of vibhavatana given in the canonical texts. But the few places where one does find some indication of what is meant, it doesn't seem to be the kind of craving that leads somebody to commit suicide. Rather, it is the craving accompanied by the view that at death everything comes to an end, that there's no continuity of personal existence, of experience, beyond death. So, craving for existence is called bhavatana. Craving for existence is called bhavatana, and the third type of craving is called vibhavatana, the craving to end existence, to end becoming. But this is the craving accompanied by the view that at death everything comes to an end, and that the person, the being, is exterminated at death. So it seems, this is the way I would understand this type of craving. It could be a case where people are subjected in the course of their life to many different types of suffering, and so they become filled with a kind of despair. And then this leads them to adopt the view that at death, everything comes to an end. All experience, all individual existence comes to a complete end. And then that view will reinforce the craving for everything to come to an end. the craving for everything, all experience, to come to a complete end at death. But according to the Buddha, this type of craving is not able to resolve the problem of existence, since this craving just supports or sustains the continuity of existence. Okay, now, interesting question. How is craving the origin of dukkha, the origin of suffering? Usually, we think of this just in an immediate psychological way. But in my understanding, there are different dimensions or different aspects to this causal relationship. So one aspect is what I would call the psychological causation. At the psychological level, craving is a cause for suffering. And we can see this most clearly in the dukkha, types of dukkha. Not to get what one wants is suffering. Sometimes this is elaborated to be united with what is disagreeable is suffering, and to be separated from what is agreeable is suffering. Not to get what one wants is suffering. So when one has a craving for pleasant contacts, associating with pleasant people, obtaining objects of pleasure, then when one fails to get what one wants, then one experiences suffering. When one loses the pleasant possessions and enjoyments and people that one has had, then one experiences suffering. Even when we possess the enjoyable possessions and the enjoyable human relationships that we desire, because there is some deep clinging to these possessions and these people, then there's some kind of underlying anxiety or agitation in the mind, and this is a form of suffering too. Clings to his wife, the wife clings to her husband, the parents cling to their children. And so even when the relationship is going smoothly between husband and wife, parents and children, but maybe deep within the mind there's some worry, some concern, some anxiety that there'll be separation, that one of the partners will go off in their own way, that the child will rebel against the parents, or the child will get sick and die. And then all of this can be a cause of an agitation or disturbance, even in the midst of a peaceful, serene, day-to-day existence. Okay, so in your own minds, maybe you can work out various ways in which there's a psychological causation between craving and suffering. But I don't think that this is an exhaustive explanation of how craving is the cause of suffering. What we find mentioned repeatedly in the text, often explained in the text, is that craving is the principal factor that causes renewed existence, repeated existence. Craving is the propelling force, the driving force behind the cycle of rebirths, samsara. And so at this level of causation, we can see that craving, the craving coming over from the previous life, is what brings into being the five aggregates that constitute our existence in the new life. Thus, craving is the, call it the dynamic force at the base of the cycle of rebirths. It's especially that craving, which is said to be seeking enjoyment, seeking delight here and there. And so, for an ordinary person, an unenlightened person, when death takes place, that craving for delight, craving for pleasure, craving for existence is not yet finished. And so that craving then becomes the seed which will bring into being a new existence. And what is that new existence? But a new combination of the five aggregates. And so this will go on from life after through life after life after life. Okay, so this way craving is the origin of suffering. Then what is, now we come to the third noble truth, what is the cessation of suffering? If suffering is the effect, to eliminate suffering, one has to eliminate the cause. And so the cessation of suffering is the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same craving, giving it up and relinquishing it, freedom from craving or non-attachment. Okay, and just as I explained two levels of causation between craving and suffering, we can also see two ways in which the elimination of craving brings the elimination of suffering. First, at the psychological level, when craving is eliminated, when the mind is free, completely free from craving, then one is no longer vulnerable to the type of suffering that takes the form of worry, stress, sorrow, lamentation, dejection, despair, misery, all of the psychological suffering is completely eliminated. And so one lives happily, peacefully, under all conditions. One is not yet free from pain. One can still experience bodily pain, illness, even sometimes severe, excruciating pain. But the pain, the illness, will not pull down the mind into a state of dejection, misery, self-pity, distress. But one can endure the changing circumstances of life with complete equanimity. And inwardly, one will always feel happy and content. Okay, so this is the psychological level in which the end of craving brings the end of suffering. But then there is the other level, the level corresponding to craving as the cause of repeated existence. And so when craving is eliminated, then there is no longer any renewed becoming, renewed existence. So with the passing away of the liberated person, there's no arising again of the compound of the five aggregates that makes up dukkha, the five contaminated aggregates. But with the passing away of the liberated person, the mind, you could say, enters or merges with the unconditioned Nibbana. Okay, then, this is the third noble truth. The fourth noble truth is the way leading to the cessation of suffering, and that is the Noble Eightfold Path, right view, from right view to right concentration. We already examined the Noble Eightfold Path in an earlier class. Okay, so I won't go over it again. Okay, so now Sariputta wraps up this section by saying, when a noble disciple has thus understood suffering, the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the way leading to the cessation of suffering, okay, just to fill in this section, you go to section 12. We've already gone through this, but I'll just go through it again. Okay, so when a noble disciple has thus understood suffering, the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the way leading to the cessation of suffering, he entirely abandons the underlying tendency to lust. Actually, you have to go to paragraph 8. He entirely abandons the underlying tendency to lust. He abolishes the underlying tendency to aversion. Okay, this shows how the noble disciple moves from the stage of stream enterer to the stage of non-returner, the third stage of enlightenment. Then he extirpates the underlying tendency to the view and conceit, I am, and by abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, he here and now makes an end of suffering. In that way, too, a noble disciple of one... Okay, at that point, the text is showing the attainment of arhatship, the fourth stage of enlightenment. In that way, too, a noble disciple of one is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has unwavering, confirmed confidence in the Dhamma, and has arrived at this true Dhamma, this good Dhamma. Okay, so this will be the explanation of the Four Noble Truths. And now, if there's any questions, please feel welcome to ask. Okay, Suki, oh yeah, please take the microphone. Yeah, I should mention that we have to stop today at 11 o'clock because today is the first of the lunar month, and so the nuns have to come and perform a little ritual here at 11.
Okay. My question is about the truth of suffering.
Yeah.
Enumerated different types of suffering, and at the end there's a phrase in brief the five aggregates of every subject to clinging are suffering.
Yeah.
Here there are actually two questions. One is it kind of gives you an impression that the five aggregates of clinging includes all other sufferings,
yeah.
Or is it like one of those enumerated sufferings?
Okay, this is a good point. In other words, is the five aggregates just a way of comprising, or let's say, recapitulating all the other types of suffering, or is it adding one new item to the list?
That's one question.
Okay.
And then
let's take each question one question at a time. What I would say is both. The five aggregates are said to be suffering and brief. One way, because it is the five aggregates that undergo birth, the five aggregates that undergo illness, that undergo old age, that undergo death. It's through the five aggregates that one experiences sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. So that's the way in which the five aggregates comprehend or comprise the other types of suffering. But also, it seems to me, the five aggregates give a much wider, much broader dimension to the meaning of suffering. Because there are many types of experience that do not fall under the previous types of suffering, the types of experience which are pleasant, enjoyable. But those are also, because they're experiences had through the five aggregates, they're also dukkha. Because they're experiences through these five aggregates, which are impermanent, empty, selfless events or processes. Therefore, they're also dukkha. Okay, second question.
Second question is, whenever I look at the five aggregates related to suffering, it is usually five aggregates of clinging.
Right.
Is there any place it's five aggregates alone is okay. Suffering? Mm-hmm.
I think one has to understand that it is the five aggregates. It's panchupadana khanda. Okay, the way I understand this, that it doesn't necessarily mean that the clinging is occurring at the same time as the five aggregates. But these five aggregates are vulnerable to clinging. Well, let us say there's a clinging underlying the five aggregates. There's only one text I know of that distinguishes between simple five aggregates and the panchupadana khanda, the five aggregates subject to clinging. But I don't know any text which explicitly speaks about what are the types of aggregates that are not upadana, that are not subject to clinging. But the way this is understood, this would be the five aggregates of a liberated person. Okay, so within any kind of unliberated person, the five aggregates are always panchupadana khanda. That there's some degree of upadana, of clinging, underlying all of our ordinary experience. So even when maybe I'm doing a meditation, my mind is very peaceful, focused on the meditation object. I don't experience myself clinging to something consciously with the mind. But there's some, you could say, disposition to clinging underlying that peaceful or blissful meditative state. And so then that clinging can come in and I grasp that state and think, I have to preserve this. I have to continue this, I want to continue this state. And the next time I sit down, I think I have to recapture that experience. And so in this way, we can see how the clinging is lying behind that experience. Okay, let us take some further questions.
Would it be fair to say that another take on suffering due to the five aggregates is really, or an interpretation of that is to say the five aggregates represent the material world and our interaction with it, and that can never be satisfactory.
Okay.
Form I would take to represent the physical phenomena of the world.
Yeah.
And all the other four or five factors are psycho-mental factors. So just looking at it comprehensively, it would seem that the five aggregates represent the material world and our interaction with it.
Okay, so the five aggregates representing the physical world along with our interaction with it.
And it says that that will always lead to suffering.
Yes.
Is that a correct interpretation?
I say it's partially incorrect, except that the form aggregate also includes the body and the sense faculties, the physical sense faculties, as being those forms in the world, that material form in the world through which we interact with the material world. So we could say that the five aggregates represent the world and our experience of the world. So I wouldn't separate form out as being something in the world but not part of our experience, because form is also that through which we experience the world, or at least through which we experience the sensory world.
In the conclusion that that always results in suffering, that is a definite conclusion.
I would say maybe not that it always, well, if we say that it always culminates in old age and death, and that way it always leads to suffering, but not in the sense that every experience is necessarily an experience of suffering. We have to distinguish these different aspects of dukkha, one as suffering, the other as being that which is inadequate or unsatisfactory. So in terms of the five aggregates, all experience is inadequate and unsatisfactory, insecure, unreliable, but it's only from occasion to occasion that the experience, that the process of the five aggregates results in actual suffering. Okay, maybe we'll take one more question. I see that I'm being given a subtle hint. Okay, if there's no more questions, then we'll end with the sharing of the melody. And then after lunch, I will come back here 12 to 12:30. Maybe we could even start. Okay, we'll make it 12 to 12:30 for the discussion period of any issues remaining from the talk today.
Asanya Sanino Dukha Bhavochantu Pusanta.